get this straight. If the indictment is... if the indictment is, and I have seen you say this, that crossfire reduces everything, as I said in the intro, to left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left.
Stop.
Why do we have to fight?
Why do you argue?
We're in bad shape, fellas. We need help from the media, and they're hurting us. You're doing theater when you should be doing debate.
You're listening to Under Surveillance, WLEW's biweekly show on popular culture, politics, and the relationship between mass media and public opinion. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and every second and fourth Wednesday mornings, I'll be joined by a series of guests as we take a look at everything from the makeup of the Supreme Court to upcoming elections and to how social and political climates impact our view of the future in film and television. Under Surveillance is broadcast on WLEW, a listener-supported community radio. And for more information or to listen to archive shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. Today in Under Surveillance, the conclusion of a two-part discussion with Robert Thompson of Syracuse University about the depiction of politicians and political campaigns in film and television. In this half of the show, we take a look at the appeal of Hollywood stars who have ventured into the political arena, such as former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura and Mike Huckabee supporter Chuck Norris. We also examine the iconic 80s sitcom Family Ties and its position as a bellwether of the Reagan era. Robert Thompson is the director of the Center for the Study of Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University, and you can listen to the first half of our conversation at undersurveillance.org. We pick up the discussion by talking about the so-called liberal bias of Hollywood, in particular the popular West Wing series with Martin Sheen. There's actually a number of people who are upset with the political slant of that particular show. And I think that's been a problem that that people have talked about for years, how Hollywood has this, what they feel is a pro-liberal slant. And certainly you have conservative commentators who say basically the same thing about the entire media, news coverage and...
It's interesting. If you look at the big names who have come out recently and become successful politicians that have come from Hollywood, let's run them down. Ronald Reagan, hardly part of a liberal conspiracy. Arnold Schwarzenegger, hardly part of the liberal, left wing. Fred Thompson, same deal. I mean, if you look at the people who really have had noticeable, runs for the highest office, governors, presidents, and that kind of thing, that this idea that Hollywood is nothing but a viper of left leaning conspirators. We realize it's not exactly true.
Yeah, it's hard to see, say, Tim Robbins attracting a widespread support for a Senate run, or say Ben Affleck. There seems to be more resentment towards those kinds of characters. And I think also, you mentioned Reagan and Schwarzenegger. Certainly Schwarzenegger, he's the action hero. He's the guy, he's getting the job done on screen. There's no one stopping him. So I'm sure that plays into the whole thing too.
Yeah, it is interesting that how when someone goes from being fiction to actual character. I mean, we're not surprised when we see people saying, Josiah Bartlett for president, and they want Alan Alda to run and all that kind of stuff. That's kind of a natural extension. But when these people actually do start political careers, it's interesting to see whether I'm not sure whether it means that the way we saw them as fictional people will forever determine how electable they are and all the rest of it. But, you're right. I suppose it has something to do with it. There are certain celebrities, by virtue of the fact of the roles they play, that if they ever decided to run for office would have to work for a while to simply distance themselves from those roles if they were the kinds that were unelectable. And it's not just people that play bad guys or smarmy guys. I wonder how people would feel if Jack Bauer ran for president. I mean, clearly a guy that can get the job done, clearly a guy who knows how to do things, but also a guy that's a little bit scary as well.
You mentioned Jack Bauer is scaring people. Well, we had Jesse Ventura as governor in Minnesota, and here's a guy who, professional wrestler and an actor, and I think in the movie Predator you had two governors, you had Schwarzenegger and Ventura, and you had a third one, Carl Weathers, who ran for governor in Louisiana, I'm pretty sure, a couple of years ago. But with Ventura, I believe he was the mayor of a small town in Minnesota, and he managed to turn that into this far-fetched run for the gubernatorial seat of Minnesota and succeeded. And talking about action heroes as well, you know, from out of the blue, we have Chuck Norris on a national stage with Mike Huckabee, you know, and that's supposed to lend credibility to his campaign, which I think is just amazing.
Yeah, it is interesting how so many people from the action adventure genre have either gone into politics, and successfully so in a lot of cases, or have become part of campaigns and all that kind of stuff. If you want to be governor of a state, having appeared in Predator is a really important thing to have on your resume, apparently. Though I think in all of these, we have to look at them in kind of, an individual basis. Jesse Ventura's career was a really, really interesting one because, yes, he was a wrestler, which, of course, a lot of the kind of base electorate, especially of some of the people who became real fans of his, were people who, you know, thought wrestling, like so much of television, was leading our children down the road to perdition and all the rest of it. Let's face it, professional wrestling at the time he was practicing it did not have a good reputation, especially among conservative anti-media types who thought it was causing people to kill each other and all that kind of thing. When he decided to start running, though, he really kind of played this idea of a regular guy, completely independent. He was going to, you know, think as a representative of the people and not according to his party necessarily or any of these kinds of things. And Jesse Ventura really did have a compelling line that he delivered. And he won over a lot of people who were not and who had probably never seen him perform professional wrestling in what was a really interesting kind of pseudo-populist, a very interesting kind of campaign. Chuck Norris, also interesting in that not only was he an action hero star, but he was kind of known, let's face it, for starring in some pretty cheesy action adventures. I mean, Chuck Norris was, is one of the, and has been for years, a running gag on Conan O'Brien for Walker, Texas Ranger. This was a show that when so much of other television was getting so much more sophisticated, this is in the era after Hill Street Blues and Moonlighting and 30-something and Twin Peaks, when television is really kind of getting to be a lot more artsy, Walker, Texas Ranger was one of the last remaining shows that still looked like something from the era of Chips kind of thing. So he was a guy who was, you know, starred in some funny, interesting action movies, but was sort of a camp and kitsch classic. And, you know, not long ago, I turned on NPR, and here he is in a long, extended interview talking about his relationship with the Huckabee campaign and all the rest of it. But, again, I think he transformed. He redefined himself. Whether you agree with what he was saying or with what Huckabee said, he was actually a really compelling speaker. He did very well in those interviews. He was a likable kind of guy. I would say that Chuck Norris, actually, when he gets in front of a microphone, can actually speak a lot better than an awful lot of people who have already been elected to really high offices. Let's face it, we've got a president right now who can barely get from a subject to an object without getting hopelessly lost in the syntax in between.
Yeah, and back in, of course, in '88, there was much made of Dan Quayle's problems with the English language, and certainly you mentioned before, you know, with Al Gore and Al Gore's primary opponent in 2000, Bill Bradley. Here's a guy who's been a senator for 20, 25 years and you know, just completely devoid of charisma while he's there at the podium. My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to another edition of Under Surveillance here on WLUW. We're talking about the ways in which politicians have been depicted in Hollywood over the years. And my guest is Bob Thompson, director of the Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. And over the last few minutes, we're talking a little bit about action heroes and their presence in the political process. And that's really, you know, it's a popular theme running through political films, certainly, that we mentioned at the outset of the show, the Mr. Smith goes to Washington idea, that the common man could come in from out of the blue and really solve the nation's problems with just a little bit of common sense. And in addition to Jimmy Stewart, we had Kevin Kline playing Dave in a film that came out in the 90s where he serves as the double for a president who I think he undergoes surgery and he winds up in a coma. So they have this guy who looks like the president serving in the White House. And, you know, hey, through his common man approach, he can basically take care of all the president's problems, you know, heal the marriage. He brings in his accountant to balance the nation's finances. And, you know, really speaks to that same message. Do you think that all of this plays into our frustration with our actual elected officials?
Well, nobody ever said that a democratic republic was going to be pretty. I mean, right from the from what it took to get the Constitution written was fraught with compromise and backroom dealings and all of this kind of stuff. I mean, the American experiment, which has been a glorious political experiment, it's been going on for a long time now, is a kind of a messy, frustrating process. But overall, if you look at the fact that it's 200-plus years, it's actually working in its scrappy kind of way. So with a process like that, for all of its glories and all of its wonders, is going to be constant frustration. And if people think that's new to the era of the Iraq War or Monica Gate or Watergate or Vietnam or whatever, need only to go back and see that problems and difficulties and frustrations with presidential politics go back a long, long way, virtually to the beginning when you get right down to it. So I think in many ways what popular art often does is to provide some kind of comforting experience of those things that are bothering us most. Now, not all popular art does this, but one of the things that popular art does so well is to comfort us, is to provide us with these visions that are more utopian than the rest of it. And there is something terribly pleasing about taking the notion of a democracy, regular people governing themselves through representatives, and actually bringing one of those regular people in to fix the whole mess at the expense of all these corrupt insiders. And it's why Mr. Smith and Dave and all these kinds of programs are so satisfying. I think so many people think, why can't these people just go there and do the job that's got to be done and not get involved with all this political mess? Of course, in real life, that's easier said than done. To get elected, the whole system of American politics with its checks and balances and all the rest of it means that it has to be political. It has to be filled with all of this kind of stuff. But it's nice to think for a second that old guy like Dave or Mr. Smith or whomever could just come in with a little bit of an integrity and some good old Yankee horse sense and make the whole thing work. And there have been presidents who have latched on to that idea and that character and attempted to, in fact, present themselves as such. Think of all the Hollywood-era presidents who have tried to present themselves as outsiders, as someone who came from, the son of grocers or from a little town called Hope or whatever. I mean, the whole thing, the log cabin campaign has been going on for a long time. Ronald Reagan, I think, in many ways created a persona of himself in that presidency that many people really did perceive as sort of that Mr. Smith goes to Washington kind of thing. He, of course, was far from the naivety and the disconnection that Mr. Smith or Dave or any of those fictional ones had, but he was certainly playing a role to an extent, and very expertly, I might add.
The other one I was thinking of was Bullworth, the other film that came out in the 90s with Warren Beatty. And he actually, he's not the outsider running for office, but he's already in office. He's been a senator forever, and he has that transformation at the very beginning of the film. And in my opinion, kind of goes over the top. He takes on this very hip-hop, gangster, rap persona, starts rapping in all of his interviews and debates. But again, playing to that same, outsider, rebel, hey, I'm a common guy, I can now solve all these issues type of image.
Yeah, Bullworth was interesting because it almost began to, to make fun of the idea of regular guy comes in with his horse sense and fixes everything, because by the end of that movie, you had to think that Bullworth had really kind of lost it. It seems like the presidency in fictional popular media, movies and television essentially, usually falls under a couple of categories. One is that it's this extraordinarily honest guy who's different from everybody else we've seen before, and that would include the ones we've been talking about. It would include the West Wing and the kind of precursor to the West Wing, an American president, which was not so much about coming in and fixing everything, but it had that whole regular guy, you know, a president falling in love, a very likable, charismatic kind of guy who always did the right thing. The flip side is you present the presidency as corrupt, as something that's part of, you know, oftentimes part of a vast conspiracy. And we see shows like 24 who have done both. We've had David Palmer, who's been the kind of noble, utopian president we wish we all had. And then we've had other people in that office who have been, in the end, where the final string unravels of the conspiracy of the season. You know, 24 has been able to present the presidency in both of those major themes.
Going back to the 80s, a couple of certainly staples of my own childhood, we had a show, Benson, a sitcom with Robert Guillaume, where he served in the staff of a Governor Gatling, who his state was never announced. It kind of seemed to be somewhere in the West, Western United States, but where he played the straight man, I guess, to the kind of buffoon of a governor who seemed continually distracted. The other element in terms of the 80s and politics that I wanted to get to is a show like Family Ties, certainly a very apolitical sitcom, but one of the long-running gags throughout the series was that Alex Keaton, the son, he was this major hardcore Reaganite, and he was growing up in a house run by his hippie parents. And it's hard to imagine a show today that would feature lighthearted barbs at George W. Bush the same way in which a guy like Reagan was treated back in the 80s. Do you think that that's true or not?
Yeah, that was an interesting show. I mean, first of all, the chief executives in sitcoms often are as buffoons. Benson was the straight man to the governor who, if he didn't have Benson, probably couldn't find his socks. Spin City, the same thing with Michael J. Fox, the assistant to a relatively clueless mayor. And then, of course, we've had shows like Hail to the Chief, a female president, where all kinds of incompetence is reigning, though not necessarily hers. Michael J. Fox and the Reagan era. Really interesting question, in that in many ways, when you think about the 80s, the Reagan administration, Family Ties is one of those real icons that kind of come up. And, of course, Reagan's picture was in a lot of the shots. Alex had it hanging up in his room. The premise of that show was kind of a typical sitcom, you know, the whole, reversal of roles. Here you had the parents who had gone to Woodstock and grown up as kind of, free love hippies. And now, of course, they were saddled with a house and jobs and kids. They were trying to hold on to their hippie identity. And lo and behold, one of their children is like the most ambitious, got his act together, honor society, Reaganite Republican that you could imagine. So on one level, it was just the typical sitcom. Let's reverse the roles. Instead of the parents being frustrated as conservatives at their hippie kids, now we'll have the hippies frustrated at their highly efficient and Republican kids. Well, that show began to morph. The hippie quality of the parents actually really disappeared relatively quickly. I mean, we would see it in the opening, but they were never quite able to keep their hippie mentality going. Alex's idea, though, as the perfect young Republican, grew as that show went along. They began to temper it a little bit much later, but he really became a kind of representative of this new youth movement, which was, Alex P. Keaton was kind of a representative of. And what was interesting is he was so likable. I mean, Alex was a lot more likable character on that show than his parents were, and not likable like Archie Bunker. Archie Bunker was lovable, but we knew ultimately that what he thought was often reprehensible. Alex P. Keaton was likable, and it wasn't as though being a Reagan supporter was reprehensible. Now, during the Reagan administration, there were obviously things being done that were probably impeachable, and we'll get into that now, but he was a likable kid who was engaged in the political process. And even though he was kind of originally presented as sort of the butt of jokes, he clearly was, of all the characters on that show, the one who had his act best together. Maybe that and his little sister. Maybe not his older sister.
Yeah, Jennifer. Jennifer was his older sister was Mallory, so it was the typical kind of 80s airhead.
That's the interesting part. I mean, the character of Alex P. Keaton was the one that back then we would have expected could maybe have become president. Now we're beginning to think maybe Mallory would have had a better chance.
And well, you talked about Alex being that quintessential 80s yuppie. And he certainly played off that. I think there was a movie called The Secret of My Success where he plays this kind of young go-getter in an executive role. And also that leads into Wall Street, the Oliver Stone film that came out, I believe, in 88 with Michael Douglas and Charlie Sheen, where the classic greed is good line, you know, taken straight from what people think as the Reagan philosophy, I think.
Right. I suppose if you had to pick out the television show, the movie, and the book from that era that kind of exemplified all kinds of things, it would probably be Wall Street, the movie, Bonfire of the Vanities, the book, and maybe Family Ties or The Cosby Show as the TV show. Not because these things were all spectacularly successful, but all of them in their own way were so much a part of their time, so much a part of the zeitgeist. Alex Keaton was an interesting character, Michael J. Fox, in that you're right. He did play this kind of quintessential, what we then called the yuppie, a word that has virtually disappeared from the language. But he was still a kid. And, of course, comedy is always you make kids act like adults, and it's funny, just like when you put monkeys in clothes, it's funny. And he was really representing he could easily have grown up to be the master of the universe in Bonfire of the Vanities or Gordon Gekko in Wall Street or whatever. I mean, he was headed in that direction, but he was still a kid. And the fact that Michael J. Fox is relatively small in structure, he was able to kind of play that off for quite a long time. It really became this kind of character that he was this yuppie in miniature kind of thing. And it was a really good act while it ran.
We just have a couple of moments left, and I think the 2000 equivalents of Michael J. Fox might be Reese Witherspoon's Tracy Flick on the movie Election. Are you familiar with that film?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a tremendous movie. Alexander Payne directed it. It came out, I think, around 99 or 2000, where Tracy Flick is this just ultimate type A high school student who's running for student council president. And Matthew Broderick plays a high school teacher who recruits one of the other students, this kind of dopey but likable jock, to run against her. And she's in overdrive, for the entire film, just determined to win this election. You know, they don't call her a yuppie. She's very apolitical. They don't really talk about politics too much. But although they do show her in D.C. later interning for a congressional representative.
If Michael J. Fox and Alex P. Keaton have passed on their legacy, it's got to go to Reese Witherspoon and not only her character in Election, which, of course, is right out of that mold, but some of the other stuff that she is that she's done as well. And I think there's always going to kind of be a need for a character like that out there. Where they're positioned in the culture at any given time depends on a whole number of things. But that sort of Alex P. Keaton mold we see much before Alex P. Keaton was ever created, and we're certainly seeing it after as well.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW. My guest has been Bob Thompson, director of the Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. We've been talking for the last hour about Hollywood and politics, how politicians have been depicted in film and television throughout the years. Thank you so much for your time, Bob. I appreciate having you back on.
My pleasure. Thank you.
For Bob Thompson, I'm Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW. For more information or to listen to archive shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. That's www.undersurveillance.org.